Chapter 30. Deficiency of power in the stomach. Take a mutton chop in half an hour, with a glass of the finest old sherry that can be got for money. Take two mutton chops tomorrow, and two glasses of the finest old sherry. Next day, I'll come again. Apostrophe in a week Arbor was on his legs, and Jilkin's success dates from that period. Arbor's great in secret information. He happens to know many things that nobody else knows. He can generally tell you where the split is in the ministry. He knows a great deal about the Queen, and has little anecdotes to relate of the royal nursery. He gives you the judge's private opinion of Sludge the murderer, and his thoughts when he tried him. He happens to know what such a man got by such a transaction, and it was £15,500, and his income is £12,000 a year. Arbor is also great in mystery. He believes, with an exasperating appearance of profound meaning, that you saw Parkins last Sunday?
Yes, you did.
Did he say anything particular?
No, nothing particular.
Arbor is surprised at that.
Why?
Nothing. Only he understood that Parkins had come to tell you something.
What about?
Well, Arbor is not at liberty to mention what about. But, he believes you will hear that from Parkins himself, soon, and he hopes it may not surprise you as it did him. Perhaps, however, you never heard about Parkins' wife's sister?
No.
Ah, says Arbor, that explains it. Arbor is also great in argument. He infinitely enjoys a long humdrum, drowsy interchange of words of dispute about nothing. He considers that it strengthens the mind. Consequently, he don't see that apostrophe very often. Or, he would be glad to know what you mean by that. Or, he doubts that. Or, he has always understood exactly the reverse of that. Or, he can't admit that. Or, he begs to deny that. Or, surely you don't mean that. And so on. He once advised us, offered us a piece of advice, after the fact, totally impracticable and wholly impossible of acceptance, because it supposed the fact, then eternally disposed of, to be yet in abeyance. It was a dozen years ago, and to this hour Arbor benevolently wishes, in a mild voice, on certain regular occasions, that we had thought better of his opinion. The instinct with which Arbor finds out another boar, and closes with him, is amazing. We have seen him pick his man out of 50 men, in a couple of minutes. They love to go, which they do naturally, into a slow argument on a previously exhausted subject, and to contradict each other, and to wear the hearers out, without impairing their own perennial freshness as boars. It improves the good understanding between them, and they get together afterwards, and bore each other amicably. Whenever we see our boar behind the door with another boar, we know that when he comes forth, he will praise the other boar as one of the most intelligent men he ever met. And this bringing us to the close of what we had to say about our boar, we are anxious to have it understood that he never bestowed this praise on us. A monument of French folly. It was profoundly observed by a witty member of the Court of Common Council, in council assembled in the City of London, in the year of our Lord 1850, that the French are a frog-eating people, who wear wooden shoes. We are credibly informed, in reference to the nation whom this choice spirit so happily disposed of, that the caricatures and stage representations which were current in England some half a century ago, exactly depict their present condition. For example, we understand that every Frenchman, without exception, wears a pigtail and curl papers. That he is extremely sallow, thin, long-faced, and lantern-jawed. That the calves of his legs are invariably undeveloped, that his legs fail at the knees, and that his shoulders are always higher than his ears. We are likewise assured that he rarely tastes any food but soup major and an onion, that he always says, by gar.
Aha!
That you tell me, sir? Apostrophe at the end of every sentence he utters, and that the true generic name of his race is the Mounseers, or the Parlez-vous. If he be not a dancing master, or a barber, he must be a cook,
since no other traits but those three are congenial to the tastes of the people, or permitted by the institutions of the country. He is a slave, of course. The ladies of France, who are also slaves, invariably have their heads tied up in belcher handkerchiefs, wear long earrings, carry tambourines, and beguile the weariness of their yoke by singing in pet voices through their noses, principally to barrel organs. It may be generally summed up, of this inferior people, that they have no idea of anything. Of a great institution like Smithfield, they are unable to form the least conception. A beast market in the heart of Paris would be regarded an impossible nuisance. Nor have they any notion of slaughterhouses in the midst of a city. One of these benighted frog-eaters would scarcely understand your meaning if you told him of the existence of such a British bulwark. It is agreeable, and perhaps pardonable, to indulge in a little self-complacency when our right to it is thoroughly established. At the present time, to be rendered memorable by a final attack on that good old market which is the rotten apple of the corporation's eye, let us compare ourselves to our national delight and pride, as to these two subjects of slaughterhouse and beast market, with the outlandish foreigner. The blessings of Smithfield are too well understood to need recapitulation. All who run away from mad bulls and pursuing oxen may read. Any market day they may be beheld in glorious action. Possibly the merits of our slaughterhouses are not yet quite so generally appreciated. Slaughterhouses, in the large towns of England, are always, with the exception of one or two enterprising towns, most numerous in the most densely crowded places, where there is the least circulation of air. They are often underground, in cellars, they are sometimes in close backyards, sometimes, as in Spitalfields, in the very shops where the meat is sold. Occasionally, under good private management, they are ventilated and clean. For the most part, they are unventilated and dirty, and, to the reeking walls, putrid fat and other offensive animal matter clings with a tenacious hold. The busiest slaughterhouses in London are in the neighborhood of Smithfield, in Newgate Market, in Whitechapel, in Newport Market, in Ludental Market, in Clare Market. All these places are surrounded by houses of a poor description, swarming with inhabitants. Some of them are close to the worst burial grounds in London. When the slaughterhouse is below the ground, it is a common practice to throw the sheep down areas, neck and crop, which is exciting, but not at all cruel. When it is on the level surface, it is often extremely difficult of approach. Then, the beasts have to be worried, and goaded, and pronged, and tail-twisted, for a long time, before they can be got in, which is entirely owing to their natural obstinacy. When it is not difficult of approach, but is in a foul condition, what they see and scent makes them still more reluctant to enter, which is their natural obstinacy again. When they do get in at last, after no trouble and suffering to speak of, for there is nothing in the previous journey into the heart of London, the night's endurance in Smithfield, the struggle out again, among the crowded multitude, the coaches, carts, wagons, omnibuses, gigs, chaises, phaetons, cabs, trucks, dogs, boys, whoopings, roarings, and 10,000 other distractions, they are represented to be in a most unfit state to be killed, according to microscopic examinations made of their fevered blood by one of the most distinguished physiologists in the world, Professor Owen. But that's humbug. When they are killed, at last, their reeking carcasses are hung in impure air, to become, as the same professor will explain to you, less nutritious and more unwholesome, but he is only an uncommon counselor, so don't mind him. In half a quarter of a mile's length of Whitechapel, at one time, there shall be 600 newly slaughtered oxen hanging up, and 700 sheep, but, the more the merrier, proof of prosperity. Hard by Snow Hill and Warwick Lane, you shall see the little children, inured to sights of brutality from their birth, trotting along the alleys, mingled with troops of horribly busy pigs, up to their ankles in blood, but it makes the young rascals hardy. Into the imperfect sowers of this overgrown city, you shall have the immense mass of corruption, engendered by these practices, lazily thrown out of sight, to rise, in poisonous gases, into your house at night, when your sleeping children will most readily absorb them, and to find its languid way, at last, into the river that you drink. But, the French are a frog-eating people who wear wooden shoes, and it's so the roast beef of England, my boy, the jolly old English roast beef. It is quite a mistake, a newfangled notion altogether, to suppose that there is any natural antagonism between putrefaction and health. They know better than that, in the common council. You may talk about nature, in her wisdom, always warning man through his sense of smell, when he draws near to something dangerous. But, that won't go down in the city. Nature very often don't mean anything. Mrs. Quickly says that prunes are ill for a green wound, but whosoever says that putrid animal substances are ill for a green wound, or for robust vigor, or for anything or for anybody, is a humanity monger and a humbug. Britons never, 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 and see therefore. And prosperity to cattle driving, cattle slaughtering, bone crushing, blood boiling, trotter scraping, tripe dressing, paunch cleaning, gut spinning, hide preparing, tallow melting, and other salubrious proceedings, in the midst of hospitals, churchyards, workhouses, schools, infirmaries, refuges, dwellings, provision shops, nurseries, sick beds, every stage and baiting place in the journey from birth to death. These uncommon counselors, your Professor Owens and fellows, will contend that to tolerate these things in a civilized city is to reduce it to a worse condition than Bruce found to prevail in Abyssinia. For there, say they, the jackals and wild dogs came at night to devour the offal, whereas, here there are no such natural scavengers, and quite as savage customs. Further, they will demonstrate that nothing in nature is intended to be wasted, and that besides the waste which such abuses occasion in the articles of health and life, main sources of the riches of any community, they lead to a prodigious waste of changing matters, which might, with proper preparation, and under scientific direction, be safely applied to the increase of the fertility of the land. Thus, they argue, does nature ever avenge infractions of her beneficent laws, and so surely as man is determined to warp any of her blessings into curses, shall they become curses, and shall he suffer heavily. But, this is cant. Just as it is cant of the worst description, to say to the London Corporation, how can you exhibit to the people so plain a spectacle of dishonest equivocation, as to claim the right of holding a market in the midst of the great city, for one of your vested privileges, when you know that, when your last market-holding charter was granted to you by King Charles I, Smithfield stood in the suburbs of London, and is in, that very charter, so described in those five words? ... which is certainly true, but has nothing to do with the question. Now to the comparison, in these particulars of civilization, between the capital of England, and the capital of that frog-eating and wooden-shoe-wearing country, which the illustrious common councilman so sarcastically settled. In Paris, there is no cattle market. Cows and calves are sold within the city, but the cattle markets are at Poissy, about 13 miles off, on a line of railway, and at Sceaux, about 5 miles off. The Poissy market is held every Thursday, the Sceaux market, every Monday. In Paris, there are no slaughterhouses, in our acceptation of the term. There are 5 public abattoirs within the walls, though in the suburbs and in these all the slaughtering for the city must be performed. They are managed by a syndicate or guild of butchers, who confer with the Minister of the Interior on all matters affecting the trade, and who are consulted when any new regulations are contemplated for its government. They are, likewise, under the vigilant superintendence of the police. Every butcher must be licensed, which proves him at once to be a slave, for we don't license butchers in England, we only license apothecaries, attorneys, postmasters, publicans, hawkers, retailers of tobacco, snuff, pepper, and vinegar, and one or two other little trades, not worth mentioning. Every arrangement in connection with the slaughtering and sale of meat is matter of strict police regulation.
Slavery again, though we certainly have a general sort of police act here.
But, in order that the reader may understand what a monument of folly these frog-eaters have raised in their abattoirs and cattle markets, and may compare it with what common counseling has done for us all these years, and would still do, but for the innovating spirit of the times, here follows a short account of a recent visit to these places. It was as sharp a February morning as you would desire to feel at your fingers' ends, when I turned out tumbling over a chiffonier with his little basket and rake, who was picking up the bits of colored paper that had been swept out, overnight, from a bonbon shop to take the butcher's train to Poissy. A cold, dim light just touched the high roofs of the Tuileries, which have seen such changes, such distracted crowds, such riot and bloodshed. And they looked as calm, and as old, all covered with white frost, as the very pyramids. There was not light enough, yet, to strike upon the towers of Notre Dame across the water, but I thought of the dark pavement of the old cathedral as just beginning to be streaked with gray, and of the lamps, in the house of God, apostrophe the hospital close to it, burning low and being quenched, and of the keeper of the morgue going about with a fading lantern, busy in the arrangement of his terrible waxwork for another sunny day. The sun was up, and shining merrily when the butchers and I, announcing our departure with an engine shriek to sleepy Paris, rattled away for the cattle market. Across the country, over the Seine, among a forest of scrubby trees, the hoar frost lying cold in shady places, and glittering in the light, and here we are at Poissy. Out leap the butchers, who have been chattering all the way like madmen, and off they straggle for the cattle market,
still chattering, of course, incessantly,
in hats and caps of all shapes, in coats and blouses, in calf skins, cow skins, horse skins, furs, shaggy mantles, hairy coats, sacking, bays, oilskin, anything you please that will keep a man and a butcher warm, upon a frosty morning. Many a French town have I seen, between this spot of ground and Strasbourg or Marseille, that might sit for your picture, little Poissy. Barring the details of your old church, I know you well, albeit we make acquaintance now, for the first time. I know your narrow, straggling, winding streets, with a kennel in the midst, and lamps slung across. I know your picturesque street corners, winding uphill heaven knows why, or where. I know your tradesmen's inscriptions, in letters not quite fat enough, your barber's brazen basins dangling over little shops, your cafes and estaminets, with cloudy bottles of stale syrup in the windows, and pictures of crossed billiard cues outside. I know this identical gray horse with his tail rolled up in a knot like the back hair of an untidy woman, who won't be shod, and who makes himself heraldic by clattering across the street on his hind legs, while 20 voices shriek and growl at him as a brigand, and a cursed robber, and an everlastingly doomed pig. I know your sparkling town fountain too, my Poissy, and am glad to see it near a cattle market, gushing so freshly, under the auspices of a gallant little sublimated Frenchman wrought in metal, perched upon the top. Through all the land of France I know this unswept room at the Glory, with its peculiar smell of beans and coffee, where the butchers crowd about the stove, drinking the thinnest of wine from the smallest of tumblers, where the thickest of coffee cups mingle with the longest of loaves, and the weakest of lump sugar, where Madame at the counter easily acknowledges the homage of all entering and departing butchers, where the billiard table is covered up in the midst like a great bird cake, but the bird may sing by and by. A bell. The calf market. Polite departure of butchers. Hasty payment and departure on the part of amateur visitor. Madame reproaches Mademoiselle for too fine a susceptibility in reference to the devotion of a butcher in a bearskin. Monsieur, the landlord of the Glory, counts a double handful of souse, without an Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.